I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Andrés Armijo. He is author of the new book, Por Constancia, So That It May Be Validated, Family History in the Rio Abajo, and he will be speaking today at Bookworks. That's at 7 in the evening at Bookworks in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Buenos dias. Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you here. Now, this book, it's like accompanying you on a genealogical adventure. You decided to do a family history complete with letters and drawings and photographs. What made you embark on this project?
Well, first of all, I'd like to... The way you describe that adventure is so right on, and I'm very pleased that you had that experience as well, because that, you know, it really has been an expedition, a journey for me. I don't know that I ever had any one decisive moment in deciding any of this. It was always something that I had ingrained in me, inherently, this inquisitiveness about my family history.
Was your family also interested in its own history, or are you kind of like somebody who's dredging up the past? I ask that because, and this is a totally different thing, but I once asked my immigrant grandmother, who was from Italy, I said, "Can you tell me about the past?" And she said, "Who wants to know about the past? That's all over." What was it like in your family? Was their history very much alive when you were a young person?
That's a great question, and I think I've been wanting someone to ask that, quite interestingly enough, because it's a combination of the two. My parents came from large families. They grew up in the 40s and the 50s. They really grew up in their culture, speaking the language, going to cultural events, making cultural events and all that. When I was small, we weren't really taught a lot about my history and my language in the public schools, and so I felt that absence.
So a real generation gap between the Spanish-speaking parents and grandparents and then the next English-speaking next generation.
Yes, that's right on. And my parents became divorced when I was about 6 years old, so I didn't know my dad's part of the family. I definitely knew my mom's brothers. They always spoke of their parents, they spoke of their grandparents, things like that. And most certainly I was involved in the cultural and social events of my community, but I wanted to know more, especially about my dad, because I didn't know about his past. So on one memory that I have is I asked my mom to take me to my dad's oldest cousin, his first cousin, to his house to meet him. And he was really taken aback that I would be so interested in my history, because he always grew up, he always lived in the place that he grew up, he stayed there, and so it was very, he was very curious as to why I would take such an interest in my family. And part of it was because I didn't know my dad, but the other part was because I just had a sincere, you know, innate curiosity about it.
Now, your family, how far back did you trace it?
Well, our history in New Mexico certainly goes back to the 1598 colonization of Hispanic New Mexico. And I would say I have genealogy branches through that date, but I also focus on the oral history of my family, which goes, you know, to the late 1800s. So on various... aspects of my research, it will go back to various time frames.
And you know that some of them came from Zacatecas, Mexico, before
right.
They emigrated to New Mexico.
That's right. But at that time, this was all of this was New Spain. From southern Colorado to Veracruz, all of it was New Spain. So they were trying to populate this area and colonize it. And so a lot of our families come from Durango, from Zacatecas, in the colonial times, in the 16 and the 1700s.
So what kind of documents have survived that told you about your genealogical history, and how did you find them?
Well, there's quite a bit. There are court records, county records. There are census records. The most beautiful records to me are the ecclesiastical records, the church records, the baptisms, the marriages, the diligencias matrimoniales. Those are marriage investigations. Those records are so beautiful because they're all written in Spanish. They have really interesting Latin terms in them. And when we read them, we are really taken to a whole other time period and a whole other place. And it's a very mystic experience for me to read those records and unfold those families that are documented in them. A baptism, the padrinos, the parents, excuse me, the grandparents, and therefore. And so when you read one of those records, a whole family, if not community, is revealed there. And those have been made available to us on microfilm, courtesy the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, the archives of the Archdiocese of Santa Fe.
And in that time, virtually everybody was part of the church.
Yes, it was a, the colony was Catholic, quite simply, in the colonial times, in the Spanish colonial period, and throughout the Mexican period.
Now, in addition to learning from the church records, there were also wills that were left behind, and so many interesting things surface when you look at people's wills. I mean, one of the things that really stood out to me was one person who owed some debts and left their children as servants to pay off those debts.
That's right. That's right. That comes from a mid-1800s will from Belen, from a woman named Mrs. Tafoya. What happened in that particular case was that her husband actually left her in debt and didn't provide for her adequately. So she was left with her children and some bills and debts. And in making her will, what she did was she assured that her children would be kept well. She placed them in indentured servitude, as they called it. But it was quite a subversive move on her part. She's making sure that she's paying her debts, but she's also making sure that her children are provided for in welfare and in education. And I think that's really, really fascinating.
Now, this is, I mean, it fascinated me because it's a history of the land that we're living on. Well, the Rio Abajo, which is really south of here. What, tell us what we mean by the Rio Abajo. That's the Rio Grande.
Sure. Well, as we know, the Rio Grande comes from southern Colorado, and it empties into the Gulf of Mexico. So it's quite a long stretch of source of life and water. In the colonial times, when they first colonized New Mexico, they divided the Rio Grande into two areas, and not for any particular division purposes, but to distinguish them. So you have Rio Arriba, which is Cochiti and Peña Blanca north, and Rio Abajo, that same area through Socorro. That's our cultural hearth. That was the government, the church, the cultural hearth between Socorro and southern Colorado. And so the dividing point is at the La Bajada Mesa.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So that's the dividing point. And my area of focus is the Rio Abajo between Cochiti Pueblo and Socorro.
So how did your ancestors live and the communities around them? What did they eat? What was their economy?
Right. Those were the questions that I had always asked myself. I wanted to know, what did they eat? What did they wear? What did they do for celebrations? All these things. In one particular second great-grandmother, in her baptismal record, her name is Balbina, Maria Balbina Jesus Aragon. And that's a pretty unique name. The name Balbina is a Latin name, and it comes from a very early Roman saint. Her name was later shortened to Albina. But in her birth record, everything is there for us. Her parents, her padrinos, her grandparents, the day that she was baptized. And so with further research, you find out what they did on the day of the baptism. Well, those baptisms in those days were very, very early in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. So you can picture this illustrious light coming up in the east in Belen, over the Manzano Mountains, and imagine that the woman had just given birth, you know, because she was baptized at 2 days old. They baptized them immediately. Right. Some babies were baptized at a day old. And with more research of writers, and you find out what they ate. They would have verdolagas. They would have wild sweet potatoes. They would have, of course, beans and chile and squash, all those corn, all of those staples of our diet.
What are verdolagas?
Verdolagas are wild spinach.
Ah.
And so there's different ways of making them. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that was also interesting was there's quite a bit of focus on the role of women. And on the one hand, women really had their place and were not marginalized because they did so much work and were so central to life. On the other hand, their sacrifices were tremendous. And sometimes they didn't get the nutrition that the rest of the family got because they put themselves last.
Indeed. And that happened with a step-great-grandmother of mine. Like you
Carlota.
Mentioned, Carlota Burnham Bernal. And she's a really fascinating character. She's a step-great-grandmother because my great-grandfather, Serafin Bernal, who was from Tecolote, his first wife, who was my direct ancestor, her name was Maria de la Paz Garcia. She had passed away in childbirth. So she passed away, unfortunately. And at that time, my great-grandfather was working for the railroad, and he moved down south to Jarales in the Rio Abajo. That's an interesting connection that I make throughout the book, is the migration of families throughout the region and how that influences the Rio Abajo. But in Carlota Burnham's case, she was a very young woman, and she was only 33 when she died. There were oral histories that I was able to record from some great aunts and uncles who were still alive when I was in high school, and I was very fortunate to have my mom take me to visit them and to talk to them and to ask them to share with me their stories of their mother. And Carlota Burnham was from Cañoncito, which is a very important place in our history. And she was part German. Her father was German. He was from Maine. And her mother was Hispana, here from New Mexico. So she had a really unique look, very unique name. And she had 6 children by my great-grandfather. But I already had 3 great aunts and uncles. What I mean to say is she raised a very large family.
Yeah.
And in those days, the corn wasn't treated, and corn was a big staple of our nutrition. There were various reasons for her illness, and she developed a disease called pellagra, and that's from a deficit of niacin. And we know that corn is our staple, and so that contributed to her illness. And I just think it's really fascinating how I was able to uncover the county record regarding her death, the ecclesiastic record regarding her death, and then the oral accounts from my great aunts and uncles.
And those oral accounts from your great aunts and uncles really make you see the difference in such a short time. I mean, within one century, of how much people suffered when they didn't have the kind of medical treatment that we demand and take for granted. I mean, the suffering that she went through before her death. And one of the things that she did was she asked a family member to chop up her bulto, her santo of the Virgin. Why, we're not exactly sure, but it was a sort of archetypal move on her part.
Very much so. That is one of the most profound stories that I so very fortunate to have uncovered and recorded for our legacy. She was very ill. She had excruciating head pains, from what my great uncle said. Her skin was very bad. And eventually what happened was, I think that she felt that the Virgen of Guadalupe was not coming through to her on her peticiones. And shortly, very shortly before her death, my great uncle Isaías had told me that she had requested of him to take her bulto of the Virgen de Guadalupe that she brought from Cañoncito to Jarales. She requested that he take her outside and chop him. And he told me that he was quite astounded at 7 or 8 years old and really did not understand what his mother was asking of him and why. And she requested that he bring her a splint of the wood after he had chopped it. And so he did. He obeyed his mother and fulfilled her request. And he asked her, well, why? And she said, well, because I'm not going to be here, and neither is she. And that's such a profound thing for me as an adult to hear, to think about, to write about. But can you imagine a 7 or 8 year old boy doing that and being obedient to fulfill his mother's wish? But in that scheme of folklore, what happens is bultos are punished when the petición, the request for blessing or healing, has not been fulfilled. And people of Carlota Bernham's generation were stuck quite tightly to their religion and to their spirituality.
We're talking to Andres Armijo about his book Por Constancia, So That It May Be Validated, Family History in the Rio Abajo. There's just so many beautiful documents, whether they be photographs, there's some paintings, there's some documents in just beautiful calligraphy. And I was just wondering what the experience was like for you and how it deepened your sense of your own place in New Mexico to be around all of these objects.
Well, it's always been quite a surreal experience for me to go look at these old documents, to go into a dark room and look at the microfilm and to really be transported into another time and place. And indeed, it's always been a mystic experience because you're looking at this very ancient writing. A lot of my purpose in my work is that we weren't taught anything about this in the public schools, about our language, our heritage, our culture. And a lot of times we're led to believe that our people weren't literate, that they, you know, just a lot of negative stereotypes. And that isn't true. Many of our people were literate. They wrote their own history. They documented it. They told it. They passed it down through generations, through the oral tradition. And that is the richness. And my experience in looking at that writing is thinking about that and recognizing that there were people that came before me and they were indeed interested in their history and they were very, very aware of documenting it also.
What kind of connectivities and connections do you feel with your past, and also what kind of disruptions and changes do you feel in your own life as an Hispano living in northern New Mexico?
That's a very intriguing question, and I feel, you know, a lot of people, when I first started my genealogical research in high school, whether it be relatives or friends, you know, they would get a kick out of it. They would make fun of me, not in a negative way, not in a bullying way. They would tease me, you know, oh, well, these are Andres' ancestors. This is Andres' ancestor room. And so I still get a kick out of it because I was very unique or odd or different than my peers in terms of my interests. And I feel very, very, very attached to my past because I've gotten to know so much about my ancestors or relatives or my community through my inquisitiveness, through my endless questions to my mom, to neighbors, to relatives. as far as my current life, I just recognize that I'm not just a person living at this time in this moment. I am very much part of my past, and I'm contributing to my future. You know, there are Saturday nights when I don't go out because I'm at home writing or editing or working on a related project. So I don't know if that is a disconnectivity. That's just my life. That's just what I do. And I am not up to date with the latest news, but my research of my history helps inform a lot of what is going on today, and it helps contextualize for me better what's going on.
Part of your research, of course, included reading documents in the original Spanish language in which they were written, and you were talking about the sort of disconnect between your parents' and grandparents' generation and your own. You grew up going to school in English and so on. What was it like to find yourself in that linguistic headspace and research mode?
I felt like I belonged there, and I wanted to drink everything that I could. I wanted to soak up and learn everything I could. Again, when I was in middle school, I was wondering why we weren't being taught Spanish, and why bilingual class was an hour once a week or whatever it was. It was very nothing, you know, and so I made the effort right away because I loved how Spanish sounds. I loved to speak it. I was hearing it all around, and I wanted to be part of it as a middle schooler, a young high schooler. And so I made the effort to learn my language that wasn't taught to me, and that helped me in my research.
And then on top of that, a more antiquated and old-fashioned Spanish, which presumably had its own words and turns of phrases.
Definitely. Well, with any student of Spanish, you have to know the history. You have to learn a little bit of the history of the linguistics. And so, particularly in New Mexico, we have a regional variety of Spanish. And Rubén Cobos, who authored a dictionary of New Mexican and Southern Colorado Spanish, tells us that that area is between the San Luis Valley and Socorro, New Mexico, where
right.
our New Mexican Spanish dialect is spoken. And so you will find those antiquated terms from the 15th and the 16th century in our spoken language still that exists, and in the written documents.
Do you have any favorite words and phrases among those legacy pieces of Spanish?
Sure. There's a word, it's an archaism, an archaic word, and it's asina. And it's the modern usage and written usage is así, like this, like that. And I was always really intrigued by that word, and that shows up in Cervantes's writing. It shows up in my mother's vocabulary today.
And asina is the longer version of así?
That's correct.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
See? Who knew? Ladies and gentlemen, you learn something new every day. We're talking to Andrés Armijo. So getting back to the question of how people lived in the Rio Abajo, you talked a little bit about what they ate. Were they mostly farmers?
Yes. This was an agricultural community that existed on their own labors from the crack of dawn until sundown, and they depended on the Rio Grande, the water that came all the way from southern Colorado, and they used it for wheat and alfalfa and to give water to the horses and the cows and the chickens, which they would in turn sell or trade or use. The matanzas, of course, as we all know, were the big celebrations where food would be distributed for the winter. There's my great aunt Atocha, who's now deceased. She talks about how they would sustain throughout the winter by making trenchas in the ground. They would save the fruit, the apples and peaches, and the chili in these trenchas that they would dig underground. And when they would go in the dead of the winter to get them out, they were just as fresh, she said, from as they would pick them during the cosecha.
Natural refrigeration.
Yeah, sustainability, you know, in the 20th century, as I like to put it, you know.
Yeah.
That's just what they did. And they thought about how to do things. And that's a really intriguing thing.
Were they also working with the acequia system?
Definitely, definitely. That was just part of their life.
And that's something that I think when we talk about how we're connected to and disconnected from the cultures and ancestors on this land that came before us, I mean, the acequia system was by necessity a collective system.
Yes.
Where it wasn't about individual rights as we,
that's
as
right.
is really the ethic of our culture now, which has some merit to it and so on, but it was really about
the community.
How the community works together.
That's right. That's right, and it was very important for people to share and to enjoy that labor because when everyone's involved in it, it's not so much work after all. You know, it doesn't become tedious. It becomes the folkway.
What can you tell us about healing practices and medicine? I mean, we're talking about a long period from your great aunts back to the 17th century, but what came down to you in this research?
Well, one of my favorite histories that I really love to think about is a great aunt, an aunt of mine who died as a baby. Her name was Pasita, and the story of her death is that she died from mal de ojo, or ojito. Le hicieron ojo a la Pasita.
The evil eye.
That's right. That's right. And my mom would tell me the story over and over because I would be so interested in it, but that a neighbor in the South Broadway community of Albuquerque had taken to Pasita, and she thought that she was a beautiful infant, but this excessive admiration had caused a spell on her, and she had bewitched her. The way that she would have not bewitched her would have been to spit on her, escupir. And but she didn't spit on her. So this was a form of excessive admiration. The mother and the child are so close, obviously through child, through the 9-month period and through the birth, and the mother is trying to take care of her. But the practices back then were that if you were to admire a baby so excessively, you would have to make a sign of the cross with your saliva on her forehead or spit on her hair, as would all happen to many, many young girls.
It's so interesting, and I found myself wondering about that. Like, what does it mean to put saliva on a newborn baby? And there's a lot that's been written lately about how we keep babies over-sterilized and they don't get the bacteria and the the good bacteria
right.
from family and surrounding that they need. And I wondered whether that was
that's right.
part of things that people intuitively somehow knew.
I think so. I think that saliva has so many dimensions of symbolism and you know, it's the embryonic fluid in a lot of ways, like you mentioned about the good bacteria and things like that, that would keep a baby healthy and safe from diseases or bacteria or virus. Yeah.
Very interesting. We're talking to Andres Armijo about his book, Por Constancia, So That It May Be Validated, Family History in the Rio Abajo. Something that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to pick up on was this prenuptial investigation, the diligencia matrimonial.
Yes, that's right.
What is that?
It's a fascinating Catholic Church investigation that happened in the 16, 17, and 1800s of New Mexico, but also throughout the Catholic world, where populations were very narrow. They were very small. Particularly in New Mexico, we had colonies, you know, we had Santa Fe, we had Isleta, Belen, Taos, Las Vegas. They were populated, but there weren't a whole lot of people that you didn't know or that you weren't related to. So when you were going to become married, you would have to have a prenuptial investigation. The term is diligencia matrimonial for that record. And it would be an investigation by the priest to find out how closely you were related, if at all. So a couple could be granted a dispensation to become married if they were 3 degrees of blood away from each other. And in those documents is where you also find an incredible amount of genealogical information, because right. so many people were related to the second, to the third, and beyond that degrees.
It is interesting that there are practices that people have done for a long time that, first of all, I mean, the diligencia, maybe that relates to a knowledge about genetics, which, of course, they didn't have knowledge about genetics, mm-hmm. but they knew things through observation, the thing about the saliva, all kinds of different healing practices that for a long time our society that got really intrigued by Western medicine, which of course is a very powerful tool, threw out all the folk practices and folk knowledge. And I think when you do a project like this, you can see the ways in which folk knowledge had a great deal of wisdom, observation, and research embedded in it.
Definitely. The archival process of genealogy is really fun. It's really fascinating. The research into the records and finding out whose father, whose grandfather, whose great-grandfather, their names, their places, all of that is beautiful, and that's the backbone of our research as genealogists and family historians. But for me, as an ethnographer and a family historian, I use that and I go to many different levels to find out about all of those things that can inform us so much more about our people, beside just their name and their date of birth and the place of their birth.
What are some of the insights of that nature that you have taken into your current life with you?
Gosh, that we are so very privileged today. And because of that privilege of technology and resources and all of that stuff, that's my social cause. That's, you know, to humanities, is to research and recover and do these types of projects so that, you know, our people won't be forgotten about these very unique things that they practice. It really fascinates me. It's informed so much of my life to learn how this great-grandmother, Carlota Burnham, passed away, and what the process of the diligencia matrimonial was. It's a really fascinating journey that I think anyone can become involved in.
Have you worked with other people also doing genealogies and family histories?
Yes, definitely. I've done some community work at the Atrisco Senior Citizen Center. And I helped those people organize their old photographs, their heirlooms, help them trace, you know, a little bit of their genealogy. Definitely. Yeah, and that's something that we have to help contribute to, because they're very interested in it as well.
How would you like this work to be taken forward? Now you've published the book. You're speaking tonight at BookWorks. What would you like the legacy of this work to be here in this large community of northern New Mexico?
Well, you know, I do this out of a creative need, out of a innate inquisitiveness, and I think because it excites me so much to learn all of this, that's what I want to share with everyone, is how exciting this can be, as opposed to our days of, you know, spending hours upon hours on the internet or watching TV or doing, you know, lots of mindless things that certainly take us away. You know, they distract us and they help us, but I want to share, you know, this productive, creative process that anyone can do. And I want to get people excited about it and show how, you know, my family is just as much contributing to our history as yours is. And I want to show that importance to people, that everyone's lives are important, not just us here now, today, 2014. Those people who have come so many hundreds of years before us contributed to us and provided the opportunities for us to be here. And so,
yeah, and not just people who did amazing things.
Right.
Ordinary people.
Right.
People who died in childbirth.
Right.
People who lived to be 3 years old. I mean,
right.
This is the picture that it really painted for me.
Yeah, my mom would take us to the Albuquerque Museum quite a bit when I was small, and she would point out particular things about how her parents would go on picnics to the Sandia foothills. They would have exhibits of that nature at the Albuquerque Museum, and she would relate that to us and how it related. And so I thought, wow, you know, okay, we're not a famous person or something like that, but we're still important, and this is what we did. And, you know, in fact, in all of those old photographs that we see published in books or in the archives, I would be wondering, you know, these people aren't identified. Who are these people? I wonder if my grandfather was there that day. I wonder if my great-grandmother could be in that silent moving picture from, you know, 1898 when they first started moving images. I wondered that, and it's possible. And so I, you know, as part of my quest, it was to identify my ancestors in all of these old photos and bring them to light and show how they contributed to society and cultural and to their cultural making. It's not just the famous politicians or the governors or the colonizers and things like that who are important, but rather the everyday people. And that's what I want to share.
And you see, for example, pictures of three girls who seem to be in confirmation dresses. They don't look very happy. What was their day like? You will never know, you know. But your imagination sort of goes to work when you see those things too.
Yeah, that particular image that I call Tres Muchachas is a fascinating image. It was taken, you know, during the Edwardian period, you know, 1906, 1907 maybe. It's very formal. They're not smiling. Well, why aren't they smiling is our question. Well, because the shutter speed was not that quick back then in photography. That's the technical reason. So a person had to stay still. But there's also a cultural decorum. This was a very important day. We don't know if it was a confirmation, some fiesta maybe. We don't know what it was, but we know that it was an important event to be photographed because people weren't taking, you know, hundreds upon hundreds amount of images back then like we do now with digital.
Exactly.
It was a very important event, and they're dressed in their best white lace dresses. And that required, you know, that decorum required them to be standing still and to be looking sophisticated. The unfortunate thing with that photograph is that we don't know those tres muchachas.
We don't know
their names.
Yeah.
We know they're related to my family, but we don't know in which way. And so that's also a reason for my publication, is to put that information out there, and perhaps someone else has a duplicate image, or someone would recognize one of those women as their mother or sister.
And even if not, there they are for posterity to be looked at and remembered for whoever they might have been.
Definitely. They've become a legend already.
Yeah. The book is called Por Constancia, So That It May Be Validated, Family History in the Rio Abajo by Andres Armijo. Andres, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.